Hello, my name is Roscoe of WNEW-FM, and what I'm about to read was written by Pete Hamill, and it's called The War. It appeared as a column in the New York Post on August 28th this year. I thought to read it because it says a lot about the effects of war. And my feeling is that realizing the effects of war is probably the strongest deterrent to war. In confirmation of that, I'd like to read you something before reading Pete Hamill's The War. As never before, the essence of war is fire, famine, and pestilence. They contribute to its outbreak. They are among its weapons. They become its consequences. General Dwight D. Eisenhower. The day was fine and lovely. One of those late summer New York days when all the girls are beautiful and all the men are polite. In dark afternoon saloons, there was warm talk about the Mets. Men headed for the parks to play ball with children. On the piers, you saw longshoremen taking off their shirts to spend a few sweet hours watching the barges slice up the rivers. It was a day made for small wonders. But Roy Peterson, Gerald Silverstein, and Richard Doyer were not here to celebrate them. Roy Peterson, Gerald Silverstein, and Richard Doyer are dead. They died in the swamps and muck of Vietnam, and their blood is on our hands. We have rather given up on stopping that war. It has become some strange and terminal disease, one that seems out of human control. The slick diplomats sit in Paris. Richard Nixon and his agents sit in San Clemente. And every week, the best young people we all know are shipped out to die. It is Richard Nixon's war now, but nobody seems to care. Nixon got a lot of publicity by ordering 25,000 men home. But there was little notice that at that rate, it would take 23 years for us to get out of Vietnam. Some nerve of moral outrage seems to have died in us. The Green Berets get involved in a gangland-style murder, and we read it as if it were a movie and not the act of men from a democracy. The troops of Company A, sick and bone-weary, their nerves shredded by too much death and slaughter, refuse to move out, and their action is treated as a one-day curiosity instead of one of the most damning judgments yet made about our filthy commitment. Already there are 38,000 young men dead. There are hundreds of thousands who are maimed and crippled. Men with steel and plastic where their bones once were. Men with poisonous dreams in the dark of night. Men whose eyes will never see a flower in spring. Men who will never play ball with their children at dusk because it takes arms and legs to do so. Those young men will carry the infection of Vietnam across all the summers of their lives. Roy Peterson, a private first class in the Army, will hear no brass bands at Seattle. He will never loll on the corner of East 17th Street and Avenue S in Brooklyn watching the girls go by or talking about the Mets. Warrant Officer Gerald Silverstein will not walk the Grand Concourse with his wife. or play a radio on a stretch of summer sand, or feel himself tickled by the rub of love. Specialist fourth class Richard Doria will never hold the sun in his arms or feel wonder or have a beer with his friends in White Plains. For them, the war is over. They had the worst luck of all. To be young and brave in a bad time. And yet we owe them something. We owe them the promise that no more of their friends will die. It should be our duty to change all this around, to stop this slow and filthy dance on the killing ground, and let our young men live out their lives. It is a measure of how much Vietnam has corrupted our sensibilities that we seem unable anymore to act on such promises. The other night in Brooklyn, I was drinking with some young men, all of whom had survived Vietnam. Not one could think of anything he had done there which was sweet and honorable. They hated the war when they were there. They hate it more now. You can con a generation just so much. And these young men know now that they were conned, that the brave politicians had never had the guts to bring this war to an end. They know that if every congressman, senator, and employee of the Defense Department were sent to Vietnam as troops, the war would be over tomorrow. If Mendel Rivers had to carry an M16 up New Lawn Mountain, he wouldn't be so brave with his mouth. But we know how wars are put together. Old men, roomy with bitterness, corruption, and power, start the wars. Young men fight them. And this time we have asked them to fight on the wrong side. Our allies are the most debased, corrupt government in Southeast Asia, a collection of blackmailers, thugs, and totalitarians. They are fighting for the integrity of their Swiss bank accounts. When the war is over, they will lie on the Riviera. Roy Peterson, Gerald Silverstein, and Richard Doria will not share their champagne. When my brother John was there as an airborne medic earlier this year, he found himself searching the bodies of North Vietnamese soldiers who had been killed somewhere near Bong Son. In the pockets of one of them, he found a wallet. The wallet contained pictures of the dead man's wife and children and a magazine photograph of John F. Kennedy. There was no way to find out why. But I would certainly have preferred to talk for a few hours with that young North Vietnamese than with Melvin Laird. That, of course, will never happen. Because like 38,000 of our brave children, he too was dead. Wear the armor of love, and you clothe your hearts in peace. This is Roscoe. Peace.